Hey everyone, just quickly before we start today's episode, I just want to let you know that this was filmed a few months ago, so some things may sound a bit off in regards to the current state of the world. As well, it's our first time recording together, and because of that, there are some minor audio quirks that we've done our best to fix up, but rest assured, it's still a great episode, and any problems will be completely fixed for next week's episode. Now, on to the podcast.
Not ready? Too bad. Head back, face forward, and hold on like you mean it.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Review Time Podcast. This is a weekly show where we discuss all the ins and outs of attractions and parks from around the world. A huge thank you goes out to everyone who listened to our pilot episode and provided us feedback to make the show the best it can be. Coming to you from Time HQ, my name is Luke Carroll, and I'm joined by my Review Time co-host Dominic Lacey. Dom, what are you wishing you could ride this week?
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of videos from different parks around the world, especially European parks, and something that I've picked up on is that European parks, even the small one, have amazing coasters. And all I've just been thinking of is that I just really want to ride a good big coaster, even something like DC Rivals, that hopefully within the next month we're going to be heading up to the Gold Coast to go and ride, because that ride is just phenomenal.
Yeah, that's a very Australian thing to go, oh, well, I want to ride something, I'll just go back to the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
I think we were there, what, 6 months ago? And we're already making plans to go back to tide us over before we can go overseas again.
Well, if we want to go any further, we have to spend like $2,000 more just to get somewhere. So spending $500 to go and ride a couple of rides, I think that's fine for me.
Yeah, it's worth it. All right, this week, to show we have no bias to Disney, we're jumping to not only a different country, but a different theme park provider as well, as we look at one of my probably top three rides in the world, and definitely my best non-Disney ride, and that is The Amazing Adventures of Spider-Man at Universal Studios Orlando Islands of Adventure Park, as well as Universal Studios Japan. Now, according to Universal themselves, in the ride, you will blast into action with Spider-Man, strapping on your 3D glasses and joining the world's most famous web slinger in a high-flying virtual reality ride. The villains of the Sinister Syndicate have stolen the Statue of Liberty, and it's up to Spidey to save the day. You'll face a cast of Marvel characters as you soar above the streets, scale skyscrapers, and battle bad guys left and right. The high-definition 3D graphics are so vivid, you might catch yourself counting the stitches on Spider-Man's glove. Just watch out for the 400-foot freefall. And to me, that is quite a bland, very Universal Studios way of explaining one of the best rides in the entire world. But before I talk about my experience with the ride, I know your experience is quite different to mine, Dom.
Yeah, so I haven't actually ridden the English version. I've only ridden the Japanese version. So as you can imagine, going into it, I had no idea what to expect. I know that I've heard from a couple of people that it's quite a good dark ride. But I didn't know if this Japanese version was the same dark ride. Was it a roller coaster? Even the pre-show is all in Japanese. There is pretty much zero English on that ride. So I just walked on and I'm like, all right, let's see what this is. Still come off afterwards. And I'm like, that was awesome. Got no idea what happened though.
Yeah, I think that's... I've been on both versions of the ride around the world, and the Japanese one is still spectacular, but you're definitely very lost. Yeah. The only English in the entire ride is the bit at the very end where Stan Lee, like, thanks you for riding and tries to get Mr. Jameson down. That's the only part in English for some reason of the entire attraction. Good on them for keeping it, but...
A little bit of solace. It's like, oh, there's some story that I can catch on to.
All right, so we'll look at some key points of the attraction. So the version of the ride that I've done the most, I've probably ridden it close to 50 times, is the version at Islands of Adventure, because when I used to live in Orlando, I would go to that park, and that was my favorite ride at the resort, and for some reason, it would never see long waits. If you went there in the morning, 5-minute wait pretty much consistently all the time, and you could just re-ride as much as you wanted. A lot of the time was like, if you are willing to walk through the queue, you'll pretty much get straight on anyway. So the ride opened with the park, Islands of Adventure, on the 28th of May 1999, And then it was so successful that it was cloned in the version we wrote together for Universal Studios Japan in 2004. Now, I remember when Islands of Adventure, well, I don't remember, I've done a lot of research, when it was being created, it was called the most technologically advanced theme park in the world. But when you kind of look at the other rides apart from this, it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, didn't it? Well, I guess it had a Julin coaster. It had that Mythos dark ride thing.
Poseidon's Fury.
Which I still don't know what it is. You've tried to explain it.
I'm not
going
to tell you. I'm not going to spoil it. You have to experience it in person like I did.
All I've heard so far is that you walk into a room and things happen, which sounds to me like a pre-show, but
I've heard the world's longest pre-show.
But like, I've heard really polarized things. You say it's amazing. I've heard from other people like it's okay, but like, I'm honestly surprised that this came out in 1999. I'm still impressed at how good some of this technology was from back then. Yeah. Even Pooh's Honey Hunt from Tokyo, that was around this time. And even for it to come back in 2004, like, this looks like technology that has only come out in the last 10 years, but it just must have been so, you know, front of the line or whatever you call it. Is that the right expression? Top of the line.
The interesting thing as well is there's only been one change to the ride, and it was in around 2012 where they redid it in 4K. So the original version was the exact same ride. It just had slightly lower quality graphics, we would say. Where the new one now is where you wear those big 4D-style glasses, a classic Universal ride. They may as well just give them to you as you walk in the door. But that's pretty much the only major change. As it stands, apart from the screens, it's the exact same ride that opened 20 years ago to this point now. And that's incredible. That late 90s, early 2000s was an incredible time for theme park rides. Rides like Indiana Jones Adventure, Spider-Man, obviously, but also like entire parks like Tokyo Disney Sea opened in 2001. If you look at some of those rides like Journey to the Center of the Earth, they're way ahead of their time as well.
It's almost as if the world was gearing up to these big new technological advances in tourism. And I would haphazardly have a guess that the reason why then after this very brief period of technological advancement, things slow down, and that's because the entire tourism market slowed down around that time. If you can imagine what happened around 2001, which we probably don't want to get too much into in a fun-loving podcast.
Yeah, it was definitely felt around the industry, especially Disney World had a lot of rides going seasonal and stuff like that. So it took them a long time to climb out. Just before that, we got some of the best rides. And I would only say in the last couple of years, we're getting back to that quality again. Like, I can't really tell you much rides I think that kind of opened between 2002 and, say, 2010 that are on par with Spider-Man or Indiana Jones. We're only kind of really seeing them now with Flight of Passage, Rise of Resistance, those in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, a lot of things coming out within the early, even early and mid-2000s were just, well, mid to late 2000s, because the early was quite good, were just very generic. They didn't seem to really break the boundaries, and I think that was generally for the sake of the consumer, because not many people could afford to travel around that time, especially with the GFC, that they were just trying to play it safe, introduce attractions that were between maybe 20 and 50 million. I know that sounds like a lot, but compared to some of these that are like $200 million for a single dark ride, like, it's something that you wouldn't have fathomed around that time, especially in the early days of DCA, which that was around mid-2000s.
2001 is DCA as well. So it's incredible to me that probably one of the worst Disney parks, a DCA, opened in the exact same year as the best Disney park in the world.
That's true. I've never really thought of that.
Yeah, and it shows you where the difference between a park made by Oriental Land Company and designed by Disney compared to a park built by Disney at that period of time, when there was quite a lot of internal struggles going on with Frank Weller passed away, that sort of stuff, made for a completely different atmosphere. And you heard a lot of people, like the Imagineers who went over to work on Disney Sea, when they came back, were shocked at the changes that had happened, because essentially parks budgets had been cut. It's just sit down, what's the cheapest thing you can do just to get something new into the park, more so than something quality.
I think just everyone at that time was a bit scared of what was happening with the market. Like, it wasn't a great time for the theme park industry.
Yeah, I'm glad we're kind of in another, like, renaissance of theme parks at the moment. And it is because of Disney and Universal are battling it out again, which is usually when we end up with the best stuff. Universal's got its third/fourth theme park, depending who you ask, opening in the next few years. We've got Galaxy's Edge, Marvel's coming up. There's so much coming up that's exciting in the world of theme parks. And I think that's because we're going back to what it was like in the late 90s.
I can't think of too many things off the top of my head that make me super excited coming from Universal. I just think their constant additions are really putting Disney in their place, because Disney has just put all of their eggs in one basket with Galaxy's Edge. And I guess now they're starting to get into the yearly additions, like especially Walt Disney World. They're getting all of the additions they should have had in the last 20 years. But Universal is just like, here's a new thing. Here's a new ride. Here's a new experience. Whereas Disney's like, here's something for one park every 3 years. And it's really generating that push for people to head towards Universal, because they're like, well, you know, Hollywood Studios, not Hollywood Studios, Universal Studios in Hollywood. They've got the Jurassic World. Not an amazing addition from what I've heard from other theme park fans, but
okay.
That's what I've heard. But for the layman, they go, oh, sick, new attraction. Where should I go when I'm in Hollywood? Well, let's go to Universal Studios Hollywood, because it's got the new ride.
Yeah, Universal has this mantra at the moment of opening a new major attraction at every resort every single year. So yeah, this year we've had Jurassic World, the ride. Next year we've got Secret Life of Pets. The year after that, they've got Nintendo. That's just the Universal Hollywood. Moving over to Orlando, we've got the Bourne Stuntacular. Woohoo. followed by the new Jurassic Park coaster the year after, the new theme park in a couple of years after that. It's the necessarily kind of quantity over quality in some regards. Like, if you look at some of the stuff that's open, like King Kong and
Fast and Furious.
They're not exactly loved, but there's still something new that they can advertise every single year that makes people go, well, what's Disney got in that same amount of time? Like, sure, this year Disney's opened a lot, and next year we've got Ratatouille and Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway and that sort of stuff, but they're opening stuff now when Universal's been opening something brand new for like 5 years in a row.
I think similar to the movie situation for Disney at the moment, like Disney has released 7 movies this year that have hit over $1 billion in the box office, which is huge. I think we're going to see a similar thing within the next 3-4 years. Disney's going to open Mickey and Minnie's. They've opened Galaxy's Edge. They've got all of these huge projects that they've been working on for ages. Can you think of anything beyond 2022, 2023 that is on the horizon for Disney?
The latest thing that I know of that Disney's currently working on that has a sort of concrete date, we've got the Avengers attraction, but that has no date, is the Fantasy expansion for Tokyo Disney Sea.
I
believe that's 2022, 2023. But at the moment, it seems to be, we've seen the most exciting stuff from Disney now in this year and opening in the next couple of years. Seems to be the next couple of years after that are just copy and pasting those attractions into different parks.
Yeah.
They kind of build the one ride, put all the R&D into the first installation. Oh, but now it's really cheap to put out elsewhere.
Well, that's why I wasn't too impressed when they were like, Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railroad is coming to Disneyland. It's like, well, you've got now these two huge experiences that are at Hollywood Studios. Why should someone from the West Coast, is that where California is?
Yeah.
Why should someone from the West Coast go to the East Coast anymore? Considering half the rides there, you've got Cars, which is a superior version to Test Track, you've got Mickey and Minnie, you've got Galaxy's Edge. Apart from some of the unique additions at Epcot and perhaps Animal Kingdom, I wouldn't even be surprised if we see Pandora eventually if Disneyland gets a third gate. That's probably going in there too.
I think there is really no reason if you're a Disneyland local, unless you love Disney that much. But most of the versions as well that exist at Disneyland and also exist at Disney World, the Disneyland version is the superior one.
Yeah.
Rides like Pirates of the Caribbean all the way up to new stuff, old stuff, seems to be that's where the money goes.
Mm. And I think because it is, at the end of the day, their flagship theme park, like, even though the Magic Kingdom is touted as the most magical, whenever Disney wants to push their parks, they push Disneyland.
Yeah. Disney World is kind of the money maker so that they can do stuff at Disneyland.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back on track. So looking at Islands of Adventure, when it was going to be opened originally, it was going to be called Cartoon World. An amazing name for a theme park. Each land was going to be themed around a different cartoon. So like Looney Tunes. We got some of that with like the Popeye stuff. Imagine that, but like a whole park. And Marvel was originally not going to be part of the park. It was meant to be DC. So, and majorly a focus on Batman and Gotham City. So we would have had a Batman stunt show, dueling Batwing coaster, not flying, luckily for you. but at the end of the day, DC and Universal, they were arguing back and forth. Like, I want 6%. I want 8%. I want 10%. Just fell through at the end of the day. The way so much does in theme parks.
I think we should quickly clarify there. Luke mentioning the flying coasters. I absolutely despise flying coasters. You are free to at me on Twitter at ReviewTimeDom. There's a lot of reasons. You're more than welcome to hit me up. I just hate flying coasters. Anyway, back onto it.
The other thing that researching this was really interesting to me was that would Marvel in the 90s declared bankruptcy. Marvel in the 90s wasn't this entertainment juggernaut that we now know it as, releasing billion-dollar films. They were bankrupt. And the only way to get out of that bankruptcy was to sell off the movie rights. So that's why we saw that first wave of, I guess, Marvel films with like the Hulk and Fantastic Four and that, was because they were just like, we need to get back into the green. Let's start selling off our properties. So X-Men was probably the best film, and Spider-Man in that era. Those were probably the strongest
sell-offs. The Raimi Spider-Man films, I think, were really what solidified Marvel back into popular culture.
I reckon those are the ones that made Disney buy them at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But also, when they were selling off their franchises, they sold off the exclusive theme park rights for Marvel franchises to Universal, and that counted within a 60-mile radius of any park that a Marvel property existed in for Universal. So, surprise, surprise, the only park it covers is Walt Disney World. So, that's why we're seeing pretty much nothing. I still don't really understand how they're getting away with the Guardians ride at Epcot. But if you look at what Disneyland is getting in the same amount of time, a whole Marvel land, Marvel rides, a Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout, the Spider-Man ride, the Avengers ride, they're just kind of getting Guardians at Epcot.
Maybe it's that thing where it's only particular brands that they can have.
That's what I heard. It has to do with, because Guardians wasn't really a recognizable brand until Disney made it such. Yeah. Something to do with that. We're not a movie podcast. I don't really quite know the ins and outs. But moving back to Spider-Man. So originally the ride was set to be Omnimover type ride. So your Haunted Mansion, Under the Sea with Little Mermaid, that style of ride where you're slowly going around a huge row of ride vehicles in front of you and behind you, never moves. But it was still meant to be like the physical sets mixed with digital screens, just with an Omnimover instead. So it would have been interesting to see an Omnimover using that, because we've never seen that before from Disney or Universal.
Yeah,
Omnimover rides are always very practical, purely practical. But the thing that made them change, and I think it was a thing that made for huge change in the industry, was Indiana Jones Adventure. That showed, even in a family park, you could have that next level of thrills. They essentially, Indiana Jones Adventure was taking a Star Tours ride vehicle, slapping it on the top of a dark ride, and utilizing that like full motion platform base. And that, a lot of people say, is pretty much what made Universal go, okay, an Omnimover isn't enough for our most technologically advanced theme park in the world. We need to do more.
That's a very good point. I've never thought of Indiana Jones as a physical simulator before. It makes a lot of sense now that you can have something that's not necessarily the steepest, fastest, you know, tallest ride that's still genuinely thrilling because you just have that context around you that makes you go, ooh, this is a bit spooky.
Yeah, if you ever find a video, there's a few of them online, of the Indiana Jones ride vehicle off-ride. The, like, bottom part itself is moving so slowly through the ride, but the top is thrashing around. Like, it's incredible the difference. Indiana Jones feels like you're getting thrown around, but it feels like in parts you're going incredibly fast or instantly stopping, but the ride vehicle is kind of just slowly moving on a track. It's the motion platform on top that's giving you all those feelings.
And Spider-Man uses that sort of system, doesn't it? Like, it uses the three-dimensional rotating.
Yeah, so the ride system, or it's called Scoop in-universe, is designed by Oceaneering, so they've done a ton of theme park stuff around the world. They were, like, literally a company who did, like, submarines and stuff like that. But they have, like a entertainment branch that does, like, trackless dark rides and stuff like that. It's very bizarre.
I have seen them come up before, especially in terms of their trackless dark ride technology. Yeah. It's interesting that they came from a Oceaneering background, but I guess it's right there in the name. So.
Yeah. So it was designed by them. So it was, what we were saying, 360-degree motion platform slapped on top of a tracked dark ride system. So I have heard people say that Spider-Man is a trackless dark ride. It's not. It is a track dark ride, but it's designed in such a way you can never really see the track. You're being faced in such a direction that I can see why you'd think it's trackless. There is a track there. It's just that you're high enough up and you're never really facing the way you're going. You're like spinning or turning, so you can't see the track. So it gives the effect of trackless, but it's not. And I think that one other interesting thing is the ride was produced by Scott Trowbridge. I'm not sure if you know the name, but he's now the head of Star Wars in Disney theme parks. So he was the lead producer of Spider-Man, and then you can see why Disney went, yes, please, come and work at Imagineering. So he's like the head of the person behind Rise of the Resistance and stuff like that, which if you kind of look, seems like the 21st century version of Spider-Man.
I can see that in the, you know, POVs and that we've seen. We still haven't actually gotten overseas to visit, but I can see how he's expanded on that experience. The only thing that I think I can't see where the inspiration has come from is the whole experience in a ride, which, like,
I think it's the trackless dark ride portion, using, you know, the physical sets mixed with the screens. That's kind of the part, necessarily the whole experience, but the actual ride part at the end of Rise of the Resistance. That's, you can kind of see Spider-Man's where we began mixing practical and scenic elements with screens, and it seems that Rise of the Resistance is the next level of that, using trackless. We're about to have a break, but quickly, one last fact is, I'm not the only one who thinks this is one of the best rides in the world. The ride actually won Best Dark Ride in the World for 13 consecutive years.
Whoa.
In the Golden Ticket Award. So that was between 2000 and 2013. And the only ride, can you guess what ride probably overtook it?
Mystic Manor?
No.
Whoa.
It's another Universal ride, interestingly.
2014. Ooh.
It wasn't a ride that opened in 2014.
Oh, Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And Harry, the
Escape from... Nope.
Forbidden Journey.
Forbidden Journey, yeah.
Yeah, the do not come to Hogwarts. Oh, you've come here. Well, we better get you out of here.
Welcome,
but remember,
to Harry Potter Ghost Train, the experience.
Don't tell anyone that you've been to Hogwarts.
But I still personally think Spider-Man is a better ride. Now everyone's going to at me on Twitter getting angry at me. But we're going to have a very quick break, and we'll be back to talk about the ride experience from the moment you see it in the park. All right, and we are back. We're going to take a look at the ride itself from the moment you stumble upon it. So at Universal Islands of Adventure, you take a left as you enter the park. You enter this sort of comic book cityscape, and the ride is there on your left-hand side. Now, I know it's quite different in Japan, so what are your thoughts on the facade in Japan?
I was writing down before, I honestly don't feel that it does a great job at portraying the experience. So the facade of Japan is the museum building that's used at, I think, the Universal Base Park.
Revenge of the Mummy is currently in the ride, and it was originally the King Kong. So it is literally that building, with just a Spider-Man slapped on the outside.
Yeah, so it's very strange to me that it's a museum, because you walk in and then, you know, as you're going to explain later, the queue has nothing to do with the museum. So I remember sort of seeing it and being a bit like, oh, neat, Spider-Man. But from what other people had told me, when I saw that building, I wasn't really like, ooh, I have to go and do that attraction, because the outside doesn't really do anything. It's just there.
It's obviously different to islands, which we'll talk about in a little sec, but in Japan, it really just doesn't fit. Like, why is Spider-Man on the outside of a New York, like, museum, natural history museum type building? And then when I walk in, why am I in the Daily Bugle headquarters? Like, it doesn't match up. I could see what you mean. The interesting thing was, for the ride at Islands of Adventure, they didn't set Superhero Island in like a realistic kind of cityscape like we're seeing the Avengers campus are doing at the moment. They set it within a comic book, so it's almost like you've opened the pages and you've stepped into the comic book. So a lot of people think it looks tacky, but I think it's interesting. So instead of 3D, it's like quite flat cutouts, giant cutouts of characters. The buildings are made to look 2D, boxy, that sort of stuff. And the ride is like Spider-Man ride. It's kind of around a corner. You can't see it when you walk into the land. And it's got the same sort of Spider-Man cutout, but then behind it is like this forced perspective sort of skyscraper. And I feel that it sells the ride better in Islands of Adventure, but still doesn't really tell you what the ride is.
Yeah, I guess with the Islands of Adventure one, you know that you're going into a comic book experience. But from the Tokyo one, is it like, am I about to go through a museum experience of Spider-Man? Which, how does that work?
A walkthrough? Is it a... Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. But luckily, once you're inside, kind of you forget about that because it's so good.
It starts to sell you more on the idea, and you can explain as to why.
Yeah, so the queue is, as we were saying, you're walking around the headquarters of the Daily Bugle, which is the newspaper that Spider-Man works at. So you can see, like, all the desks are there. You go into the next, it's like the dark room where they're developing pictures of Spider-Man. And you're going around. It's not the most interesting queue. It does have, like, a model of the ride vehicle, which is interesting. And they're, like, using that as an in-universe way. Because the kind of the story before something goes wrong in a classic theme park way is that you are on this, like, ride vehicle that seeks out headlines. So that's why it's called Scoop, because it will like zoom to where it's meant to be so you can like get pictures and write down stuff happening in whatever the city, Spider-Man city called. Is it just New York?
I think it's just New York.
Yeah. Like a made up city.
Boston.
And I think what we were saying before is it's really hard to get a good idea of what the ride is until you're in the ride and going around that first corner. Even at the load platform, you don't know what the ride's about to be. Getting on that ride, it could be essentially a Fantasyland dark ride. You have no idea that ride system has that full 360 degree motion platform on it until you get on the ride, you take a left, you see the spider signal, and the ride kind of comes to life and starts moving in this 3D way. It's very similar to Indiana Jones, when you go around the corner and then it starts to move in that three-dimensional space. And I think that's a whole part of the experience. I had heard that it was such a good ride before I rode it in 2015 for the first time, but I didn't know much about it. And I think that's why I love it so much.
It does have a lot of surprise factor, because especially with the queue, like everything is physical. You've got a lot of props around that you can touch, and I really like that. It was as if you were within a comic book, but it's all like painted in comic book colors. It looks like a background set almost.
It looks like a comic book in 3D space. Like it's painted in that comic book style. It doesn't look like an office. It looks like an office from a comic book.
But it does set up that atmosphere that, oh, this is just going to be your regular dark ride. It's going to be a dark ride through a comic book. And then you hit the loading dock. And if I remember correctly, it's quite dark. I think it's trying to be
like a cityscape on the back wall.
Yeah, you can hear the sounds of the city going on, and you're getting on this scoop vehicle, which I had no idea what it was called because mine was in Japanese. And then once you get on it, you're like, okay, this looks very similar to Indiana Jones. So if you've done that, you're like, well, let's see where this goes. once you turn that corner, it's not just that the ride starts moving. It's the fact that the music starts. You've got all the visuals coming out. You've got the Spider-Man signal coming around and you can see the projection effects of Spider-Man. You really start to get a sense like this is something a bit different. This is going to be a bit unique.
And there's no that first scene where, you know, you're rounding the corner and Jonah Jameson's screaming about this spider signal as he does. Is completely practical effects. So it gets you into this, it kind of lulls you in, like it gets you in nice and soft, the practical before you get to any of the 3D stuff. And so, yeah, you round that corner and then you've got that first scene, which is kind of cements the ride as just how good it is. You've got the projection of Spider-Man on the screen, but when he jumps on something, it physically moves in real space.
That's
the part where you're like, this is not a normal ride.
Exactly, and I was just going to say, that's the part that I went, ooh, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, when you feel the thump of Spider-Man, and it feels like he's on the edge of your vehicle.
Yeah.
It's like, this has taken screens to a next level. Yeah. I actually feel like I'm involved mm-hmm. in the screen, instead of the screen just being an element as yeah. part of the ride.
Because problem I have with a lot of screens is, they're just flat walls at the back of a space. They don't add a lot of depth a lot of the time. I see it in Ratatouille, I see it in a few other rides, when you can see the floor and then it just at a right angle goes up into the screen, it removes the immersion for me. Where Spider-Man's screens are so well designed, it has practical stuff around it, so like he jumps on that ladder, it swings, and he jumps on your ride vehicle, it bounces a little bit. Those sort of things from the very start of the ride show that it is that next gen. Everything had been thought about in that ride. It wasn't just, okay, round the corner, here's another screen. Round the corner, here's another screen, which is almost what I feel Transformers is, and it's kind of meant to be the next gen version of Spider-Man, even though to me, Spider-Man is still way better. And I think that that start of the ride from just seeing the spider signal to going around the corner, it's only probably 30, 40 seconds. But it is one of the best introductions to a ride in the world. It has just that wow moment after wow moment of, oh my.
Yeah, and I think with the screens as well, something that I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're always sort of leaning back. So you can't really see. There's quite a big lip on the vehicle. You can't see the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, so that's the other reason why you can't really see the track at points, is because you're quite high up. It's not necessarily that you're leaning, it's just that you're high up and you're constantly almost moving in some way to keep your eye off it. But they'll also have, so instead of a screen just finishing on the wall, like wall and then floor, 90 degree angle, they'll have like boxes or something around it. And then sometimes those boxes will be continued in the 3D space to bridge that gap. So it'll be half practical, half 3D, stuff like that. All right, so then you go around the corner and in a classic any theme park way, something goes wrong. You're kind of going through a sewer, you round a corner, there's some rats, and you start to see pretty much every major Spider-Man villain that they could get. So the Sinister Syndicate, which is Scream, Electro, Hydro-Man, Hobgoblin, and of course Doc Octopus, are in this like secret underground lair. And the whole story of the ride is they've got this magic gun that can lift stuff up, and they've used it to steal the Statue of Liberty. So there's a point where like there's a Statue of Liberty's head as a practical effect, which gets like lifted up above your ride vehicle, stuff like that.
I love how over the top the ride is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take itself seriously at all. And I think it really fits the Spider-Man universe. Mm-hmm. Like, you sort of undersold that effect in a sense. You turn around after they've shot you with the green laser, I'd like to call it, because I never got a name. It was just something in Japanese.
I'm sure it has a name, but I don't remember it, and I've written it 50 times, so the effect is more memorable than the weapon itself.
The when you turn around that corner, the head of the Statue of Liberty is huge.
Yeah, it's not quite full size, but it is massive. And like, it's overwhelmingly big.
It's just floating above you, like heading off into space, and you're like, oh, neat.
and it's another one of those perfect blends. So the gun is shot on a screen, but you then see a practical beam come off the screen, hit the Statue of Liberty, and she starts to rise up. And it's those interactions between the real and the digital world that really sells the ride. Then you've got other parts where It's quite intense. It's sections where you, like, start spinning really, really fast. And it probably isn't as fast as it feels, but it's kind of jerking around at the same time, and it feels like you're getting flushed down the street. And then it comes up to probably my second favorite part of the ride, which is, I think it's the Hobgoblin. He's, like, on this thing, and you can see there's a physical bridge which is turning into a digital bridge, and he starts just throwing pumpkins at you.
Oh, yeah. And pretty much when he throws those pumpkins at you, the first one gets flung off by Spider-Man, but he can't stop the second one. It then gets deflected off the screen, and your vehicle during this time is reversing, so there's practical effects happening around you. By the time you hit the next scene, the second pumpkin goes through a wall that you can see on one side, but then a physical explosion with pyrotechnics happens on the other side of that wall, and that's when you're just like, ooh!
Yeah.
you just don't expect that.
Yeah, and I think that shows that perfect blend of 3D and practical, because the first one comes at you because you're wearing those 3D glasses and feels like it's about to hit you until Spider-Man pulls it away, and then the next one is a practical effect, which just brings you into the ride. And I've ridden this ride without 3D glasses, a classic review time, Luke and Dom. If you've ridden a ride 100 times with glasses, take them off and just look around at the scenery. I've done that. I couldn't see outside the ride. There was points where you never look at, and I'd turn around, there'd be like a billboard, in-universe billboard there. It's just incredible.
That's one of those things that I love, is when the ride sort of respects that the perspective is from the viewer. Mm-hmm. So it's not just going, all right, you need to look here because that's where you're telling you to look. Eventually, if someone wants to look around, they can. And having those billboards on the back wall and that will be like, oh, wow, cool. You're not taken out. You can immediately come back into the ride. And I think that just shows a lot of respect for the guest.
Yeah. I think it's treating a guest like a human and not a camera.
Yeah.
And then it gets up to, it goes through a few bits. You see some different, kind of each of the villains has their own room. So Electra, like, shocks you and your ride vehicle vibrates in a really weird way. Hydro Man gets you wet, which I don't know what it is about Universal, but they have this weird love of spraying you with water. Pretty much every major ride that's 3D based sprays you with water. So Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey, the spider sprays you with water. This, obviously, the Hydro Man sprays you with water. I just remember these, like, when you walk into a Universal park, especially in Orlando, give you the glasses, as I was saying before, and give you a poncho, because you're going to need those glasses and you're going to get wet. But those, like, mix of practical effects with the water and the fire, with the practical scenery and the digital stuff, is what works well. And then it gets to pretty much the third act of the ride, which is the most spectacular effect. As if the other stuff we've talked about up to this point wasn't spectacular enough, there is an effect that makes you feel as if you are riding up 400 feet, which is what, like, just under 100 odd meters?
I think it's around 50 stories.
Yeah.
The context of what's happening is you've been shot by the green laser. So you're now rising up through the cityscape of New York. And I just want to quickly touch on something that we haven't talked about, is that whereas some rides seem to just go, here's a scene, then nothing, here's another scene, like as you go between them, this ride transitions so well. There's pretty much no dead space. Mm. Whenever you're going between the scenes, even if there's not a major screen or a major set piece, you've still got this amazing context. Like just before you're lasered, you go through, is it like the subway?
Yeah, and that's the part where you're spinning. Oh, sorry, that's the sewer. And the subway, the Stanley, one of the Stanley cameos, he comes out on like a truck and almost hits you.
Mm. And as you're heading up the tunnel, sorry, the car tunnel, the subway for cars, you are on a flat plane, but the way they angle the roof and slow down the ride, it looks like you're slowly going up this crack in the ground that takes you into the streets, and then you're hit by the green laser and you're heading into the air.
Yeah.
And as you were saying, that effect, the first time it happened, I was like, hold up, stop the ride.
Yeah.
Can I just watch this for 10 minutes? Like, well, how are they doing that?
I remember, especially Not as much now, but back then, I was absolutely petrified of heights. Back into, like, 2015, kind of the highest coaster I'd ever been on was, you know, like 40, 50 meters. Now it's more than double that, and I'll happily go on any roller coaster. But back then, I got petrified. I thought it was a real effect, and we were going really high, and we're going to drop. Like, I didn't think it was me completely sitting still and the room moving around me. I thought it was real.
Which is the effect. Yeah. But I guess you've got Dr. Dooms next door, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably thinking, here oh, no. I go.
This is how they load you. And yeah, it's done by a combination of physical pieces of set falling to the ground, projections of like lighting on the side that makes it look like windows are going down, as well as the screen in front of you, all working together to sell the effect. And it really does sell the effect. And then that kind of leads into the end of the ride. You're on the building, you fall off the building, which is a very similar to the end of Transformers, where you're on something and fall off it as well.
Well, I think they managed to really sell that effect. Like, the entire time, there's a point where you sort of flip and you're now facing downwards, but the way they've done that is that they've got the cityscape on a horizontal plane, but in such a way that you feel like you're vertical. So it's on an angle, you're sort of like leaning forward and it's the city is coming at you. So you've got these skyscrapers around you, the screen sort of really far away. Mm. And it really sells it that you are just floating around.
Yeah. You're on, and then, yeah, you get kind of skipped like a stone to the edge of the building. You fall, you get caught by Spider-Man. Spider-Man saves the day at the end of it. You see another Stan Lee cameo. I think there's four in the ride. One audio only, and three are in the ride.
I think it's the same one in the truck.
No, there's one in the truck. There's one where he's got like a woman with him, and he scoops her like into a comic book store. And then I think there's one other. That's at the very end where you like fall and you're caught by Spider-Man. You're looking directly at a building, and Stan Lee's there and like walks her in. And I think there might be one more. And then there's the one that we're talking about at the very end. And then at the very end of the ride, it wraps up nicely. You go, you've saved, you've stopped the Sinister Syndicate, you've got the green laser, technical name, gun. It's being fired into Mr. Jameson's office, and he's like floating around the room. Stan Lee wishes you the best in English and Japanese. And then you kind of unload, and you kind of go, what did I just experience?
Yeah. You sort of sit there and go, I need to do that again, because it, even though the transitions are amazing, because you've never got that downtime, it's just like, bam, 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 get off. Mm-hmm. You're sort of just like...
Like it doesn't, from that first point when you're round the corner and see the spider signal, and to the point where you pull into the unload, it's just constant. There's no down points, there's no down beats, all of it's high quality. There's no like, nah, this part's eh. It's just somehow stays up there, stays positive. But... we will have a quick little break now, come back, talk about the legacy of the ride where you can see some remnants of it today. All right, so The Amazing Adventures of Spider-Man, one of the best rides in the world. I don't think, even though you haven't ridden it in English, I'm not sure where it would sit kind of in your list, but it's definitely in my top five rides overall and definitely in my top three dark rides in the world. How, where is it kind of sit for you, not having experienced it in English?
It definitely does sit high in terms of ride experience, but I rate my rides differently. I've got personal rides, things that aren't really...
they mean something to you, even if they're not the best rides in the world.
Things like Space Mountain, you know, very basic attraction. It's a roller coaster, but it sort of introduced me to theme parks and got me into effects and all of that. It was sort of that introduction because it was so basic. So I've got that list. In terms of technically sort of superior rides that I've ridden, it's definitely in the top 10. I do think that very similar to when you watch a movie in a foreign language, sometimes you can really appreciate what's happening on screen, but it can be a little bit difficult to follow at times. And I think that did take away from it. But I still think all of the core rides there, you've got this amazing experience. It just made it a little bit, the flow didn't really work as well.
Yeah, I feel Universal Studios Japan, that's probably one of the harder rides to understand as well. It's very storyline driven. So while you can experience and appreciate the effects, it's hard to experience the story. It's not like Jaws, where it's very obvious you're being attacked by a giant shark.
Yeah, you've got a shark coming out, and they go through, like, you know, just talking regularly, and they're like, oh my gosh, shark! Yeah. You can't really get that sense of urgency, because a whole sort of experience in Spider-Man is just like,
if you know, like, you can understand a basic, like, basic understanding of the plot and stuff like that, but I can understand why, like, I probably said stuff and you're like, oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what it is.
I picked up, you've got the Statue of Liberty, but why they were doing it, I guess because they're just super villains.
They're bad guys.
Why are we there? I'm not sure. I guess the ride just calls for it. So I think it would make more sense now that you're in that vehicle. I was just like, why is there this vehicle that James Jameson, or whatever his name is,
James Jameson.
why does he have this vehicle? So it now makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to go back and do it again. But
I'd be interested to see where the ride sits after you've experienced it in English. Now, will it move up, or will, because it's not going to be as much of a surprise, it will kind of stay where it is in the quality of your attractions? Like, the surprise is such a major part of that ride because you're not expecting it. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure we'll get there eventually.
I think
it's, get you on it.
It's similar to when you go to a different theme park in a different language. Especially with the Disney parks, there is something special about being in your own sort of park where everything's in your language. I love going to Tokyo Disneyland, Disney Sea, Universal Osaka, but there is that barrier that's hard to get past, especially with the language. It's nothing to do with any problems. It's just that it's hard to immerse yourself in something that you feel like you're on the outside of.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And that's the thing to me. It's like Tokyo Disney Sea is our vote for the best theme park in the world that we've ever visited. Imagine how much better it would be if everything was in English. But moving on, it's interesting. The next place we would see a ride system like this wasn't at a Disney or a Universal, but at Busch Gardens, Williamsburg, in a ride called Curse of Dark Castle.
Oh.
And it was pretty much this exact ride system. It was a story of kind of a werewolf who lived in this castle. And it was, from everything that I've heard of people who rode it, it was spectacular, pretty much on par for a regional park as what you'd expect from Spider-Man. And then Universal came back, and if you've ridden Transformers, you've kind of ridden Spider-Man, same ride system, same idea, but Transformers was designed to be the West Coast version of Spider-Man. So it was meant to go to Universal Studios Hollywood, which is where it first opened. But then they put it in at Universal Studios Florida as well, at the Studios park.
Well, I guess if you can have them both, you might as well.
But I don't know. I might be in the minority. Going on Transformers, to me, just shows how much better Spider-Man is. And making them like a 10-minute walk apart from each other kind of shows the weaknesses of Transformers, even though it's a newer ride.
Yeah, I haven't ridden Transformers. When I last went to Hollywood, the Universal Studios Hollywood Park, I always want to call it Hollywood Studios for some reason. Damn you, Disney. That attraction was the effects studio where you go through, like, here's CGI, here's makeup.
The special effects stages.
Yeah.
I love the special effects stages. I really did.
But so now it's been replaced with Transformers, which I've looked at bits from it. My two criticisms are, I think it embraced screens too much. Which makes sense. We know Universal of late, they do love their screens. And the other problem is it seems to take itself too seriously. I think Spider-Man works because it is very camp. It sort of knows that it's not this immense sort of experience. It's
comic booky, and comic books back then especially weren't comic books back then weren't what they are now. Like, Marvel films are very serious now, very build this universe, very, you know, the world's going to end. Spider-Man, especially, if you, like, look at comics and pictures and the original animated series, didn't take itself too seriously, and this ride is like that as well. Like, if you were to be like, ah, here's the ride. To explain it, there's an electric guy and a fire guy and a water guy, and they're trying to steal the Statue of Liberty. Like, it sounds silly, but the silliness is what sells it.
I think, like, if they were just trying to steal a random jewel, it wouldn't work as well. It's when you turn around that corner and you can see they've got the entirety of the Statue of Liberty, and you're just like, oh, okay, they've gone high stakes.
And it's, yeah, I think, as we were saying earlier, it kind of ushered in this new era for theme parks. And if we're looking at the major rides being launched at parks around the world nowadays, they're this style. Like, the major ride when Shanghai opened was Pirates of the Caribbean, and it is like a water version of this type of ride. And Rise of the Resistance, the dark ride part, is a version of this. Like, the rides we're now thinking of as the cutting edge rides are the next version of this ride system that's kind of 20 years old at this point. Like, this not necessarily ride system in like the vehicle and stuff like that, but this blending of screens and practical effects to tell a story that you couldn't do through animatronics and set pieces alone.
Exactly. And I think Disney's first attempt wasn't Pirates or Rise. It was Ratatouille in Paris. That's using the trackless ride system. And you can see the inspiration that they've taken, whether they would admit that they have or not, from Spider-Man. How they've sort of trying to incorporate the practical effects with the screens, but it has the massive problem of Disney really wants capacity. So you have four rats in one area with a screen. So you look to the left and there's a rat doing its thing, watching a screen in front of you. The screen is just like literally flush with the ground.
That right angle screen.
I've heard that the attraction just does not work as a POV and you really need to experience it. And it's got some cool effects. Like, there's one point where you go under an oven and they turn the oven on, you get blasted with heat and you look up and there are screens. But other than that, I don't feel like Disney did their best job embracing it. Maybe just for budgetary concerns, remembering that Ratatouille was one of the first dark rides outside of Hong Kong and outside of Tokyo. So it was the first one out of Asia.
It was the first completely funded by Disney as well, wasn't it?
I think so. And so their priority would be making sure that the dark ride system itself worked, and I guess that the attraction was good second, if that makes sense. They want to make sure that their dark ride system is perfected, and the rest is just bonus.
I think it was a spectacular addition for that park, and that park was really struggling with an identity crisis, and it still kind of is. It was a perfect addition for that park, but it's not the best realization of this ride.
And that's Walt Disney Studios in Paris?
Yes, that's where Ratatouille is. Obviously, now it's going to Epcot. Opens next summer, I think.
It opens like late next year. I know that they're doing media events for it at the moment.
Oh, wow. I guess it is a carbon copy ride, just in a different language, so it shouldn't take too long to build.
But everyone has come out of it. I've seen a couple of things where it's like, oh, no, I can't tell you anything about Ratatouille, even though it's a carbon, copy.
Wow, you could go to Google Translate and get a sneak peek at the ride. But I think 20 years later, Spider-Man is still not having ridden Rise, but it doesn't seem like... Like, it seems like the evolution, but it's not necessarily the same type of ride. I'm pretty sure Rise doesn't have a motion platform or anything, does it? Like, it's a trackless dark ride, but it doesn't have that motion platform to give you that tilt and the awe and the pan and the...
In one part, I think it does, but I won't go into it because I know you don't want it to be spoiled.
I think it's still... In my opinion, is the best version of that ride in the world. It's in my top three dark rides, along with Mystic Manor and probably Journey to the Center of the Earth. And so it's an incredible experience. If you get the chance, I think a lot more people will have and will get the chance in their life to ride this than have or will get the chance to ride Mystic Manor that we talked about last episode. But don't let the facade at either park turn you off the ride. It's spectacular. I don't think I've had anyone who's walked off being disappointed. You don't really get sick, even though it's a screen-based ride. If you get the chance, please go on it.
It is still the masterclass on merging practical effects and screens. Mm-hmm. I think if anyone's looking for inspiration, stop trying to reinvent the wheel. Yep. Go back to Spider-Man.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Review Time Podcast. Any last minute little additions you'd like to throw in there?
No, I think I've mentioned everything that I wanted to about Spider-Man. Same as you, if you get the chance to write it, definitely give it a go. Every time I have gone back to Orlando, I have skipped Universal, and everyone calls me crazy for that, but I only have limited time off, guys. I
did 14 days at Disney World last summer. Couldn't even take a day to go out to Universal Studios.
I want to do Flights of Passage more than once, so
and that's a whole day just to wait in the queue.
No, you've got to sit outside the queue just and refresh the fast pass system.
All right. If you do want to get in contact with either of us, you can do so on Twitter. If you have any comments about the podcast or just anything in general, I am at Review Time Luke.
I'm at Review Time Dom.
Very fitting. So thank you so much again for listening to this episode of the podcast. We will be back next time where Dom's bringing an attraction to me to talk about. Thanks for listening. See ya.
The Review Time Podcast is brought to you by Luke Carroll and Dominic Lacey. Special thanks to our patrons, Jake Cool, James McRoberts, Jeremy Kalfakis, Luis Nugira, Luke Schiacitano, Peter Matthews, Ruben Mays, Ray Dredge, and to you, the listener. The Review Time Podcast will be back next week.